HD Smartcast. You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Welcome to the Investor Hour podcast. I'm your host, Rahul Goyal. The goal of this podcast is to learn from the best investment minds of our times. We want to learn their backstory, essentially, what makes them them. We want to learn how they make their decisions in their personal lives. And of course, we want to learn about their core principles of investing. Essentially, a lot of learning that could help you make better decisions in life and investing. Bikash Khadoya is the head of Asia's largest REIT. What's a REIT? Well, it's a new investment opportunity that you should take note of. More on that in this episode. We also talk to Bikash about what it takes to do well in residential and commercial real estate as an investment opportunity. And very interestingly, we get a unique insight from Bikash into how MNCs are thinking about India as an investment destination. Listen in.
So Bikash, thank you very much for joining us on the Investor Hour. I must say, especially for our viewers, this is a slightly off-track episode because typically we're discussing investments and stocks and shares in that context. Today, we are on a different track, which is property. But one thing is common. The common thread between the two is the view on India and how these correlate to that. So I'm personally very excited to do this, primarily because there's very little to go around when it comes to discussions of property in the retail, you know, viewer domain. And having Bikash on was a brilliant opportunity to talk to him both about real estate and also about REITs, which is a new way to take exposure to real estate. So I'm so happy you could make time for this, Bikash.
No, thank you so much, Rahul. It's a pleasure and I'm looking forward to this.
Wonderful. Okay, let's kick it off. Typical Investor Hour stuff. Let's kick it off from right where you grew up, where you studied. Tell us a little bit about yourself. We just want to understand the background to what we're going to discuss. Yeah.
Sure, Rahul. So, you know, I was born, brought up in Hyderabad. You know, so very small town guy. Now, Hyderabad is not a small town anymore. But, you know, studied there all, you know, throughout my education. Did my 12th and also my college there. I'm a chartered accountant by profession. So, you know, I completed my chartered accountancy while I was in Hyderabad. And in fact, I did my internship, which was the first start you know, as I got to understand the corporate world and got a little bit of experience, is Ernst & Young. I interned with Ernst & Young for 3 years. And post-qualification of CA, when I was around 21, I joined them back in their fraud investigation team. So that's been my typical, that's been my, you know, early years, formation years.
So let's just be sure we heard that right. You were in the fraud investigation team.
That's right. I mean, so my childhood was, you know, pretty simple, like, you know, everybody else's, you know, my parents obviously had a large part to play in kind of the way, in the values and the way I think. And, you know, if there's one lesson there before I come to the fraud investigation is that my mom was pretty a tough woman, a woman with tough love. And she was like, effort is non-negotiable. It's okay to fail, but it's not okay not to put in the effort or to. So, you know, there were times when I would say, you know, maybe, you know, I'll skip the exams or, you know, I was unwell and I'll write some other time. And I was always a good student. But she's like, you know, even if you fail, you know what, it's okay. You know, you don't need to get a rank. And as luck would have it, I was, you know, fortunate enough because of, you know, her push, I, you know, went ahead, wrote the exams, stood All India First in CA when I was unwell. So I wanted to skip the exams. And, you know, so those were the formation years. Ernst & Young was a pretty good experience. And this was still in Hyderabad. Fraud investigation typically makes you think out of the box. You know, they used to say typically that you need to think like a fraudster to kind of identify a fraud. So that was pretty good for me. You know, it gave me pretty good understanding of lacunas or areas where, you know, processes and risk can kind of completely go southbound in a business. So I did that for a couple of years and I was still in Hyderabad. Then I joined a startup company as a CFO. I was pretty young there that time. So I thought it was a fantastic opportunity. It was a tech startup in Hyderabad. And I did that for a year. You know, they were trying to raise funds.
Which year was this?
This was about 2006, 2007. So I passed out in 2004. So I was, I did the CFO role for that company raising funds. And that is the time actually I met a lot of private equity funds. This was into gaming and tech. So, you know, I met a lot of early stage and mid-stage VC funds in Mumbai. And that's where, you know, the investing and the private equity bug caught me. And, you know, that is, yeah.
So, sorry, if I can just go back a bit. You spoke about your mother. Can you just tell us about your parents, what they were professionals, what were they doing, and a little more?
Sure. So my dad was a businessman. So okay. He was into trading business, trading of goods, which I use in vehicles. And my mom was a housewife. So pretty simple, pretty middle-class upbringing, which I think has really helped in the way, you know, my thoughts and views have formed out.
And all along in Hyderabad?
All along in Hyderabad, till I shifted in 2007, all along in Hyderabad.
Very interesting. So, because, yeah, I'm just trying to form the picture. So, you graduated in 2004, you said, right?
That's right.
And you're in Hyderabad. Hyderabad is a beautiful city. I've been there, I think, once or twice, and I love the place. But Hyderabad's also produced. So Hyderabad's, when I think of Hyderabad, two things come to mind. Some of India's top infrastructure companies come from Hyderabad and the nearby region, right? And since you mentioned fraud, it reminds me of Satyam Computers.
Yes.
Which was Hyderabad, right?
That's right.
So I wonder whether you graduated in the context where Satyam, the big revelation of riding a tiger, was I think 3-4 years old.
Actually, it happened live when I was still doing my chartered account. It was just about the time I was starting my career. So it obviously, and a lot of my peers were in the ecosystem, surrounding the Hyderabad audit and surrounding just generally the company. So there were a lot of conversations, a lot of learning from, you know, something which we thought just was next door. But the interesting thing I must tell you, Rahul, that while Hyderabad has been known for this, but also, you know, that was literally the time also I saw really the tech outsourcing and the tech, business tech boom take up in Hyderabad. Like I literally seen, within a span of a very few years, that sprawling new buildings and lots of talent and lots of education institutes producing that talent, the STEM talent, what we call the science, technology, engineering, mathematics, that kind of came in. And I've seen a rapid growth of the city in a very, very short period of time, right? Till 1995, 2000, it was a pretty sleepy, laid-back small town. And then, you know, really with the tech boost that the government at that time gave, I really saw in a span of 5-7 years, tremendous, tremendous improvement, tremendous change in the entire ecosystem in the city.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's an army of people who made that work. But that was Chandrababu Naidu's phase also, right? He was
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. So there's been a fraud when you're studying. It's also the place where there's a lot of real estate, all infrastructure. And not a coincidence that you got involved in this field. So I know you're still taking us through your career journey. So let's go through that, because we know ultimately it ends at all real estate, right? Sooner or later.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
I'm pretty passionate about it, but in the early years, maybe, you know, it takes some time to kind of define or specifically what you would, what you think would really be passionate about. So I moved after that, as a CFO for tech startup really gave me amazing insight into how venture capital and private equity funds I was 22, 23 year old, and, you know, going with my CEO, who was an industry veteran at that time, you know, I just had to listen in. And for me, it was amazing training ground of, you know, how they think. And then I used to kind of handle some of the questions, and, you know, they can get into pretty details into business models and, you know, how we're thinking about growth and expansion, organic, inorganic. So that was pretty good 1 year, journey for me. And then I got an opportunity in Mumbai with a real estate fund, a residential real estate fund, Piramal Capital, it's called now. Earlier it was called India REIT. I just thought it was a fantastic opportunity to kind of, one, be an investor, so start thinking like an investor, and to be associated with real estate. And as you said, real estate is something where every Indian has a special place in their hearts, right? You know, everybody has been associated with real estate, whether it's as an investment or whether it's as a safety net or whether it's, you know, so I thought that was a pretty exciting time. And this is, by the way, 2007. So we were at the peak. This was just before the global financial crisis. So 1 year before that is when I joined, and we were, nobody could do any wrong in real estate sector in India at that point in time. So my first impression of the sector was, you know, wow, this is great. And everything works out pretty well. And that's how, you know, I moved to Mumbai and started. And then 2008, 2009, the global financial crisis happened, which kind of really changed a lot of things and really drastically impacted overall context of real estate, especially the land bank game, you know, the play on just investing based on Excel sheet model of growth over the 5-7 years without factoring in execution risk, without factoring in how much the market can kind of really take up, how much supply. And, you know, so I think it was a pretty good period of 2 to 3 years between 2007 and 2009 where I saw dramatically opposite ends of the real estate cycle.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, the Piramals were well funded, right? They only got hit because the markets collapsed, but they didn't get hit by a crunch or anything, right? Like,
no, I mean, it's a pretty credible name, great pedigree. So, you know, it was just about during that cycle, how did the investments play out? Hmm. And the learning was, you know, you need to kind of be flexible on time horizon when such an event happens, once in a decade or once in a 15-year event. And, you know, because sometimes it's just when the global financial crisis and a lot of investments were in Hyderabad, what I used to oversee. And that time Hyderabad was going through this separation of state, Telangana state discussion. So, you know, that did impact the real estate sentiments. And for me, it was a pretty good learning in resilience on sometimes just being patient, because as young guys, we would always love to go out there, get things going, you know, get the projects moving, you know, start the sales, make. And this was residential real estate that I was focused on, and, you know, make the revenues and the numbers work and exit the projects. But sometimes you just need to kind of respect the overall context of the market, you know, the sale environment, you know, the demand environment, and then take a call on the project. So that 4 years, just to cut it into, you know, briefly, 4 years I was with the fund. First year was pre-GFC. So pretty exciting peak. And then next 3 years, we're really lessen in resilience and patience.
Yeah. But thinking from an individual's perspective, so, you know, if you look at suburban Mumbai, if you bought an apartment in 2005 or before, I think before that, everything was slow. You know, the world was still recovering from the big TMT meltdown, et cetera. So money has started coming in, but not that much. The property prices really did skyrocket on the residential real estate over the next 5-10 years. I guess a thumb rule in at least suburban Bombay was it multiplied 10 times between 2005 and 15 or something like that. What would be the lessons you took away as an individual, or what would be the lessons you think individuals should have taken away from that? Where were the opportunities that actually worked? Where were the opportunities that did not work? When it came to real estate, residential real estate?
Yeah, so, you know, in residential real estate, I think my firm two views are one, you know, individuals need to have a medium term horizon. I mean, while we hear of, you know, doubling, tripling the money in 2-3 years time, I think, you know, for value to be created, if you're investing in a project which is in the process of being constructed, which is where the most value creation happens, you kind of need to be patient for the cycle of the value creation need to be completed. I think
you would find medium term, how many years for you?
I would say anything between 3 to 5 years is a good time period to give the, you know, it's not magic, you know, because then it would be pure speculation. And that brings me to my second learning, which is stay away from speculation, right? While we keep hearing that land prices are increasing, they may continue to increase for a couple of years, but, you know, it brings down that, you know, just because others are buying or prices are increasing, is the intrinsic value the same? So I think it's about just overall context of individuals. How are they looking at real estate? Is it for their own use purposes, in which case the risk reward is completely different, in which case, you know, the location they're buying at is really important because it's a long-term investment / own use property. But when you're looking at it from an investment perspective, I think Similar to what we say in stocks, that you need to have a medium-term horizon at least, because flipping it is not, you know, there's no quick money in flipping it. There may be obviously a lot of examples where people have made money like that, but, you know, especially when you lever up, when you take debt and try and see if you can make opportunistic speculative returns, I think that's something, you know, the learning has been to kind of stay away from. I think the most value creation happens when you, you know, it can be residential real estate, it can be plotted development. It happens when you kind of go in there early with a reputed name where, you know, you are assured of delivery and kind of just ride out the entire period of value creation, which is typically a 3 to 5 year cycle of completing the construction.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned there, it's so important that you have to go with a reputed name and you're assured of delivery. Because I guess a lot of the people, even though the location may turn out to be right, but if you are stuck with the wrong person and doesn't get delivered, that's how fortunes are made or destroyed, right? Yeah, I think we've seen it time and again, and that's such an important part of real estate investing. Now, before we move on to your next jaunt, if you will, do you remember anything, some completely crazy deal coming to your table and which you did or did not do those days? And live to tell the day, of course.
Lots of them. I don't want to take name, but lots of them. But typically, you know, Rahul, you know, the euphoria was that, you know, we have got X 100 acres of land and, you know, we can just in 5 or 6 years build an entire township with, you know, thousands and thousands of homes. And, you know, and hence, you know, the land per, you know, per acre cost of land or price of land should be Y, which is obviously a, you know, an exorbitant sum. And, you know, if you look at the Excel sheet, you know, everything works out perfectly, but, you know, it's just that, you know, can you execute that much in the time frame estimated? Will the prices hold up? You know, everybody was picturing in a perfect world, whether it's on execution, on demand and everything. And, you know, that's why you would hear of prices per acre going up suddenly from, you know, a few lakhs to some in crores or in hundreds of crores. So I think, you know, we've seen a lot of those, and that's why the learning that, you know, Excel sheets, sometimes, you know, you just need to kind of take a lot of practical on-ground view and not just rely on Excel sheets, because you can extrapolate any growth rate in that to derive a value or a number today, which you need to kind of pay for if you believe in the Excel.
Is that what helped you stay grounded and close to reality when all this euphoria was happening in those days?
Yeah. So, you know, honestly, I was still learning. I still am learning, actually. But at that point in time, you know, what helped is, you know, we had already made a lot of investments in 2007. So just seeing what we thought at that time versus how they panned out. And, you know, this was still best judgment. Nobody thought a global financial crisis or Telangana state issue would happen, which would kind of really pause, so to speak, the real estate activity, you know, in the city. And for me, the learning was really just seeing how it was panning out. And, you know, you know whatever you would have factored in when made the investment, actually newer areas to address and newer risks kind of panned out. I think for me, that was a pretty good learning that in India, you know, it's just not good to make a great investment. It's also how you see through the big business execution. And then eventually, if you want to exit, you know, how do you do it in a reasonably successful manner?
Yeah. Okay. So from the great financial crisis and India REIT, which is now Piramal Capital, where did you head next?
So, you know, I got this opportunity with Blackstone, and, you know, obviously Blackstone is a hugely well-regarded name. And honestly, I thought I was out of my depth to kind of even, you know, target the role that they were looking me for. It was for commercial real estate. I had zero experience in commercial real estate. This was 2011. And two, of course, you know, it's a great brand, and, you know, huge respect for the way people go about the business there, you know, the culture, etc. So I thought, you know, it was a long shot for me. I never did an MBA at that point in time. I subsequently recently went to one of the great business schools to learn more. But, and I was like, you know, maybe this is, and the recruiter at that time was pushing me that, you know, no, I think your profile would really kind of fit the bill that they're looking for. And, you know, and I guess maybe my experience of seeing some of the tough times in Hyderabad, the resilience I spoke about, all my fraud investigation experience, I think may kind of have helped me to kind of pitch myself as someone who would probably have safe pair of hands as they were looking to expand into India and with their growth journey. So they were just at that point, as a context, they were just looking to make their first acquisition of an office property in India. This was 2011. And fast forward today, you know, Blackstone is obviously has been the first move and deployed a huge amount of capital in the office sector in India.
Yeah. So just explain to our viewers, when you say that Blackstone was getting into commercial real estate, tell us what exactly these guys do. They bring in large pools of capital, and then what do they do with it, and how do they expect to make the money?
Yeah, so you know, just to kind of give a little bit brief of the real estate, commercial real estate as well, players in the market at that point. So India, in 2005, 2010, was a very nascent market. It was still evolving as a commercial office property proposition. And, you know, this was a time when global companies were starting to look at India for outsourcing. You know, which meant, you know, they were outsourcing contracts and, you know, hiring people in India because of the talent. And hence, the need for real estate came up. And then, the large, reputed developers started developing large-scale business properties, buildings, which is where this whole thing got started. So 2006 to 10, 11 was just that period. And what Blackstone did was, you know, their business model is to partner with these large developers in India who were developing commercial office properties and provide them growth capital. So, you know, provide them capital so that, you know, they can grow the business even more, expand the commercial office properties, given the fact that the demand was starting to really look good, the outlook on demand. And India from that 2011 to 2018 has really seen outsized demand, simply because there was more and more outsourcing happening, more and more offshoring happening to India, and which meant more jobs and hence more need for office space in India.
World-class office space.
World-class office space. And, you know, in a short span from 2011 to end of this 2020, Blackstone really became the largest office landlord in the, you know, from a private equity perspective in India. They invested in a lot, many platforms. And, you know, I was lucky enough to kind of be part of the team to see the entire journey from one investment to, you know, a lot of investments over a period of time.
So I remember in the 90s, when DLF started setting up in Gurgaon or opening the offices, and they were talk of the town, right? That they made those amazing offices, people would go and see, and et cetera, et cetera. But you're right that, so Blackstone brings the money, the developer probably pulls in the land, or if he's already built something, and then they develop it to a world-class scale. And that's what the big companies need when they're coming to India. And when Blackstone is making this investment, so typically when we're doing real estate in India, most people really think capital gain, right? You buy an apartment and you think in 10 years it'll double, triple, and I'll make some money and move on. But when you are doing commercial real estate, the yield is really important. Is that right? I'm asking all basic questions. I have no clue about this. I'm just trying to learn more as we go along.
Yeah, so, you know, you got to a very good point. So just to add to the previous one before I get to this, Rahul, you know, also what large, private equity players get on table is also a lot of, learnings and a lot of best practices, because they have done this before in other regions globally. And hence, you know, we say it, you know, it's kind of a great collaboration between a local partner who knows the business environment or context in the India or in the city and a global institutional investor. And I think that's how kind of even Embassy REIT kind of got formed and set up and grew. But just to your previous point, I mean, commercial real estate, there are two things. One, there's a initial yield. So as you lease out the property, you're getting rent, every month from the occupier. And leases in India are pretty sticky. Now, what I mean by that, it typically, unlike a leave-in license or a renting of a house, commercial office lease is typically a 10 or 15 year lease. It's a 5 plus 5 year lease horizon. And the indexation or the escalation happens every 3 years of 15%, so 5% a year. And because these are occupied or taken up by global high quality occupiers, and I'll come to the kind of customer base we can cater to, and they spend, unlike most other regions globally, in India, the occupiers are the one who are investing in the furniture and fit outs, the interiors of the office. That's why it makes it pretty sticky, because they're also putting a lot of capital. And sometimes, we've seen large global corporates are spending more on the furniture than what we have spent per square feet basis on building the building which we have given to them. Wow. So, you know, it makes it a very interesting. So one is the initial yield component. And, you know, the yields at that time in 2011 and even today continue to be pretty attractive. For example, Embassy REIT today, even as a listed player, the yield is about 6.5%. You know, it's pretty attractive. Whereas in a residential setup, you'll be lucky to get a yield of 2-2.5%. And obviously, you have to deal with property tax and repairs, etc. Yep. So that's one. But as you said, more importantly, there is a growth element to this. And hence we say, you know, obviously, looking at a REIT or even looking at a commercial real estate investment, we need to think about the total return. So REIT obviously is there. It comes every month and every year and the money is coming in. But also what happens is over a period of time, the capital value of the asset appreciates. And the asset appreciates in value for multiple reasons. The rents obviously go up over a period of time. In our cases, actually, the market has grown even faster than what our contracted rents have grown because India was just scaling up on its office premises and, you know, the sector was getting institutionalized. You know, you get an opportunity to kind of reset the rents to market as one occupier leaves and someone else comes in. You can actually enhance or increase the rents even further. Then as a large platform as Embassy REIT, you know, and I'll come to what a REIT is, but as a large company owning a lot of commercial real estate, you also get an opportunity to organically grow the business, which is developing newer buildings, and the yield on cost or the returns on new development is pretty attractive, especially given the fact that once you already own large scale business parks, office properties, the expansion of additional buildings in the same business park, you know, you will get demand from within the same, you know, park, and the absorption is pretty good. The location is already well established. The asset is already known in the market very well. And to add to that, is the inorganic growth opportunity where you can use balance sheet to acquire more. So, you know, in nutshell, the growth aspects of whether it's rent or whether it's you're building newer properties or you're acquiring new properties, all of them helps to appreciate the value of the real estate investment you have made, whether it's through a unit in a REIT stock or whether you actually bought a commercial real estate property. And, you know, and when you add the yield and the growth component, is how you get the total returns. And hence, we always keep saying that investment in real estate and REIT units is a total return story. While this yield, which really helps because every quarter you keep getting returns, you know, in the form of rental receipts, but also you get this appreciation in the capital value because inherently the land and the building are becoming more valuable. The replacement cost, you know, what it would cost to build a new building, and if you were to rent it out, makes it pretty attractive to kind of own real estate.
So tell me something. I read this some years ago, and it's a conundrum also for me to understand this because it's typical that the kind of real estate, the high-end real estate, like the ones you guys offer, is probably averaging $1 a square foot in rent, right? And I was reading somewhere that the international benchmark would probably be $3 per square foot. We are sitting in Nariman Point. Equity Master works out of Nariman Point in Mumbai. We are paying $2.50, $3. How come you guys are paying $1? Is it because people book hundreds of thousands of square foot? Is that the reason?
No. So, you know, let me take a step back. You know, so you're absolutely right that the rents in India are pretty low. And, you know, that actually is one of the key reasons why we think India office is set up for a long-term structural advantage. But just parking that point for a minute, you know, the ex-Mumbai, so excluding Mumbai, the rents in for office properties and large-scale business parks in the rest of India typically are about $1 a foot a month. In Bangalore now, because its rents have been increasing, Bangalore continues to be number one market in India on office, rents are now inching towards $1.25 to $1.5 a foot a month. But just to put that in context of what we see globally, the rents in Singapore are somewhere around $15 to $18 a foot a month, not $3. It's $15 to $18. And those are the occupiers who are, you know, looking to set up offices in India. The rents in Manhattan would be even higher, $50, $70 a foot a month. So just if you see as a context, the rents in India, sometimes we actually say are embarrassingly low, which also means that they have a lot of runway for growth, which really places us and investors are looking at commercial real estate as a sector for investment, you know, it makes it pretty attractive for them. Now, between the cities, of course, Mumbai is just the, you know, the capital value scarcity, the scarcity value of land reflects higher, reflects in higher capital value and hence higher rents. But, you know, typically the businesses and the occupiers are looking for, at large scale formats. So just to kind of set this up, why are these large occupiers in India? The large occupiers are in India because they want to access talent. And India has one of the most favorable demographics globally, especially given that we churn out 2 million STEM talent graduates every year from our colleges, and given the fact that the rest of the world is witnessing aging population. And to, on top of that, the labor cost in India, even if you were to include all the costs of outsourcing and oversight and additional manager, you know, managerial oversight, is typically about 35 to 40% of the cost that these large global multinationals would have in, you know, in other global regions. So that's why the labor arbitrage in India really works, and the productivity, and most time, this is the feedback consistently that we have been getting in the market. The productivity in India is far higher than what you see, you know, in other places, simply because Indian talent.
We work harder. We work harder. We work a lot more.
Exactly. Indian talent works harder. You know, they have a certain outlook on how they want to grow their careers. And that's how typically they've been brought up. So because of this, these companies are looking to outsource and offshore more and more work to India. And where do usually they come to the cities which can offer them the talent? So you see Bangalore being the number one market in India. We spoke of Hyderabad. Chennai is picking up pretty well. Then there's Pune. While Mumbai is a financial capital and it's more front office, smaller format, kind of an office market. And you have the big banks and all of them coming. But the same banks and other occupiers, they set up the large scale business, as we call factory of the world, factory to the world, you know, to the world's offices. They set up the large scale formats, the 2 lakhs, the 5 lakhs, the 10 lakh square feet formats here, while they would set up a small sales and marketing or a front office for the, you know, for the board or for the senior management in Mumbai. And that's why you would see typically the rents in most cities in India, other than Mumbai, would be in the range of $1 a foot a month.
So if someone's got a very long-term perspective, and if someone believes, and rightly so, on the India opportunity, that in the next 10, 20 years, you know, the gap between us and the developed world will converge, then a commercial real estate is one way to do it. And then, like you were, like you've been explaining, you can do it via direct ownership of commercial real estate, or you can do it via a unit, what is called a REIT. So that's pretty interesting. And I love the fact that you mentioned that Singapore is $15-$20, you said roughly. And then you said Manhattan is $50-$70. This is a long runway. Huh? You guys must be, you're in the right sector at the right time, probably, you know?
Yeah, so, you know, absolutely, Rahul. I'll tell you two things. You know, again, not everything is homogeneous. So it's not that all office properties would see similar demand and rental growth. It's not that all asset owners or landlords would see the same kind of quality and growth of opportunities. The reason I say that is because these large occupiers, globally well-known companies, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, and these are general names in the market, not specific to our portfolio, a Microsoft, you know, a Google, a Salesforce, a Swiss Re, they are looking to come to India not because the rents are cheap. They're looking to come to India because India offers the talent pool and they can continue to scale up. And I think that is the one thing which really places India very uniquely. I often tell our investors and, you know, our team that really Embassy REIT is not a play on real estate. It's not, you know, it's not a play on growth of real estate. Embassy REIT is really a play on talent, India's talent, skills and availability. Because as long as the talent is available and those demographics are pretty favorable for us for a long, you mentioned 10 years, you know, for next 10, 1 or 2 decades, you know, we're really well placed. I think these large scale global occupiers will continue to come to India. And hence, rent is just one of the outputs or byproduct of what would that offshoring mean. It would mean that there would be more demand for higher quality spaces. And the landlords who can actually provide those world-class facilities. Yeah. At Embassy REIT, we often refer to total business ecosystem. So gone are the days you would construct a very efficient and swanky looking building with nice facade. I think India has matured even further as an office market from those times. So now the occupiers, the large companies are looking at the ecosystem. What are you able to offer? Are you able to offer amphitheaters, food courts, play areas, sports zone, you know, wellness for employees? It's a big theme today. You know, ESG, and then, you know, we have hotels in our office premises and parks, you know, and because that's pretty complementary in terms of convention center, in terms of conferences. So the occupiers are looking at, can you give us a world-class premises and an ecosystem which will help us to attract and retain the best talent? So the play is, can you partner with them in the journey to find talent and retain talent in India? If you're trying to just look at how to max out on the real estate footprint and kind of squeeze the last rupee or dollar, the occupiers are not looking to economize or squeeze on the dollar. And hence, the kind of properties which are really mid-tier, grade B, non-grade quality will always have a pressure, downward pressure on rents.
So the gap will only increase between the
gap will only increase. Consolidation is happening. Better quality occupiers are willing to pay. And again, think of it from their perspective. They're running large businesses globally. They've taken a call that India outsourcing and offshoring really works for them. So they want to send more and more work to India because of its talent. And if you can give them quality premises, it's already costing them pretty low cost or rent on rents to be here and pay us, right? So they're not going to economize on that. But things which really matter to them, if you can provide them, which is ecosystem, which is employee wellness and all of that, really they wouldn't mind paying a premium. At Embassy REIT, if historically, and we continue to, through the COVID period and even now, we continue to rent at premium to market rent. So just to answer your question earlier, rents in India have a really huge runway for growth over the next decade, two decades for an investor who's looking at commercial real estate. But the key thing is the quality of the portfolio and the scale. You need to operate at a large scale. A globally big occupier will not take up a 2,000 square feet premises. They are looking at a million or 2 million square feet. And that also kind of brings us to the point of, do we own commercial real estate directly or do we do through a platform like a REIT? And I think the advantage in India's favor on commercial real estate is pretty huge. It's a dual advantage on both labor availability and low cost of labor and rent. I think it's about, you know, who can scale up and provide those kind of product which a global occupier would want. So simply put, if a global occupier wants to be in that premises, then yes, that has a long headway for growth.
So just to pick up on the last point on you went to Blackstone, and then after Blackstone, you've effectively been in a similar role, right? Blackstone had a partnership with Embassy, am I right? And
yes,
with, so and you worked with them and then you've come onto the REIT. So we'll jump a little bit over there and come straight to the COVID period. So, you know, I've of course read all the transcripts. I've read everything on Embassy REIT in the last couple of years. So I have a sense of what happened, but give us a picture on how did the commercial real estate market perform during the COVID times? And are there any takeaways for investors, potential investors, from a future perspective?
Yeah, sure. So as a background, we listed on 1st of April 2019, Embassy REIT. So what REIT is typically a portfolio of lots of underlying real estate, in our case, commercial office buildings. And that helps us, that helps in generating regular income. We spoke about the rent and the yields. And obviously over a period of time, capital appreciation through the growth and, through rental increases. So we were set up as a commercial REIT. We were the first in India to be set up as such. And, you know, today we happen to be the largest office REIT in Asia by size. We are today 44 million square feet of area, and we are an office-focused REIT. We do have hotels, but that's as a complementary to our office business. And when we listed, we saw a lot of inherent demand from global institutional investors when we went to roadshows. Of course, they needed a lot of education was needed in terms of what are the fundamentals of India office market and why that works well. And you know, they understood REIT as a product very well. So REIT, just as a context, has been in existence in the United States since 1960s. It's a $2.5 trillion asset class. So REITs are not new. It's just that in India, the regulations We set up in 2014, 15, and then we were the first to get listed. So that's just the background. The first year, we had a pretty good run, in terms of our total returns, in terms of our dividend yield, as well as growth elements, we did pretty well. And then obviously we all saw the COVID period. So let me kind of fast forward to today of where we stand and then get into what were the learnings from the COVID period and what we saw in our portfolio. So often investors ask us, what do you think is a black swan event, and what do you think, how, you know, what will be the impact on your business? We just, even today we get asked this. Of course, investors just want to know what are the risks that can get us, you know, that can kind of put the business model to a challenge. And you know what our response usually is, that COVID was a black swan event. It, you know, COVID was the worst that we could, a commercial real estate landlord could see, experience, in terms of just, you know, we are offering office premises and one fine day everything's shut and nobody comes to offices, or very few people come because there's a global pandemic. And then what happens to the business? But, you know, we say that, you know, that was the black swan event. And even during that time, we performed pretty well. So if you see the numbers over the last 3.5 years since we got listed till today, we roughly have distributed about 6,000 crores of dividends. But despite two of the 3.5 years being in the middle, you know, in the middle of a pandemic, we collected a full 100% of our rents. No rental waivers given. In fact, we have doubled down on our growth and the construction. So today, as we speak, we're doing about 7 million square feet construction, which is the highest we've ever done in the history of the company. And we'll come to the growth element and what we are seeing as we move forward. So we've been pretty resilient through the COVID period, and total returns over this period has been 44%. So if you were to buy a stock at IPO, you know, it has given a total return of 44% over the last three and a half years, with about a 12% CAGR a year. So that in an environment where it was a global pandemic, and which directly affected office premises. Yeah. So we've done reasonably well, and we are even more enthused and positive about the prospects as we move forward. But what COVID has taught us is a couple of things. One, and I'm sure you hear this often, Rahul, in your podcast, is there's no substitute to quality. I mean, no matter what you try and do, you can buy cheaper buildings which cost lesser, but quality is questionable. You can have occupiers or customers who are not of the best quality, but they can, in a shorter period, pay you higher rentals. You can kind of take a little bit of shortcut on construction cost and build cheaper product, because the returns work out pretty well if your cost of creation of the asset is lower. What it taught us is no substitute to quality. So if you do not build a world-class premises where the largest and the best occupiers and companies globally will want to come, then simply put, they will not come. And then, you know, it will always be a downward spiral on rents. So the reason our portfolio held pretty well. So today we are at about 87% occupancy on a 34 million square feet operating portfolio. That's the largest operating portfolio in the country by size. And 87% is the lowest occupancy we have seen despite the COVID period. And if you compare this to individuals who are owning real estate directly or some of the other landlords in the country, we've heard stories of occupancy falling to as low as 0% or 50, 60% or 40%. In Mumbai, it's even been tougher. And that is what a REIT does in an investment portfolio. If you have a large scale properties and you invest whatever the size you want to invest in the units, because the asset pool is large and because it's high quality, even if one or two occupiers go, or if you kind of refurbish one or two buildings and kind of the rent stop coming, you still do pretty okay. So COVID taught us that there's no substitute to quality. The second thing we learned is we always have to think medium long term. There's no shortcuts. So we had an instance where I don't want to take the name, but we had one of our largest occupiers who wanted a large discount on the rents, and they occupied a large chunk of the premise. And we always believe that we continue to invest in the properties, and we're spending monies, and we always believe that we have to lease at market and premium to market, because also that helps you to reinvest in the property. So it becomes a positive virtuous cycle. And you know, in the middle of the COVID period, we took the tough call of not negotiating ourselves down on rent, and we took the call of letting the occupier go and relocate. All right. And what that meant was in the short term, the occupancy dipped, the net operating income also came down. By the way, the number I told you is post all of that, so still pretty well. And we are leasing those premises today at 2 or 2.5 times the rent, because the in-place rent was pretty low. There's a large lease, over a 10, 15 year period. So never, short-term calls don't help. So always think of business as medium and long-term. And the third and the last thing I think is we always say the network effect on the business. So, we have our team spread across locations. We are currently in 4 cities, but multiple locations within the city. There's no substitute to quality relationships and long-term relationships, whether it is on the supplier side, the vendor side, or the customer side. And a lot of demand that you see are the deals from companies who you have been conversating with for some time. So COVID taught us that, let's take the hard call. If some of the business models of some occupiers were challenged, like airline industry, retail industry, hospitality industry, the office premises of those players were challenged. So no matter what you do, they're going to have a tough time. So we let some of those occupiers vacate up offices. Still, our occupancy was pretty resilient at 87%. We have seen that we have been able to backfill those same premises at much higher rentals with much better quality occupiers. So quality, medium term, and if you're running a large scale business with 65,000 shareholders and growing, there's no substitute to thinking about business from a medium long term perspective.
So much of what you've said correlates to investing, because one of the biggest challenges has been in recent years, the proof whether cigar butt investing works. Just because you bought something cheap doesn't mean it'll work for you, right? And as you referred to our podcast, so I'll share with you. On our podcast, we've had multiple guests which have said it's okay to pay premium for quality because in the long term, they are the ones who deliver.
Absolutely.
So the learning just sort of completely fits in perfectly well. And the point you mentioned, right? You have to take a tough call. If a tenant is not willing to meet your criteria, you have to let them go. Similarly, if in your portfolio you got a stock that is not performing, and if there are parameters that are sort of not meeting up, you have to exit. No choice. It's tough luck. You do your study, be sure, and I'm sure you let the tenant go because you knew there was a fair value, which you would ultimately get, and that's what's worked for you. I find it very interesting that so much of this overlaps with investing in stocks. That my only concern is for our viewers, if they are individual property owners, 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 square feet. So some of these lessons are very important for them because they may not be in a position to leverage on the advantages you have. So they have to figure out how they're going to navigate, unless they have the pool of money to diversify away that risk at that small level. So you can diversify away that risk. But the alternative, like you said, is a REIT where you got this, millions of square feet of office space, premium occupiers, and this long runway ahead. The yield is what is very interesting. You had 6.5%, roughly 6.5% you mentioned. That's a very good yield because that still does not factor in the capital gain, right? The capital gain hopefully will come over time. But
we really believe that there's a huge potential. I'll give you some of the initiatives that we are doing, and I'm sure there will be the play in the market on growth. Is we are constructing 7 million square feet at attractive yield on cost, which means basically we are investing in expanding the portfolio organically, and the returns on each additional building or each additional dollar or capital that we put in is pretty attractive. It's much, much higher than 6.5, which means that it will help us enhance the overall portfolio return as we deliver those buildings and lease them out. Yep. Two, we have made a super successful acquisition of Embassy Tech Village in December 2020, which is middle of the COVID period. We acquired a large-scale office park, which is about 10,000 crores. And that has been very accretive to investors, both on dividends as well as on the overall growth. And it's outperformed all our underwriting assumptions at the time of acquisition. And then the rents in our portfolio are currently about 20% below market. So as the leases expire, we can keep pushing the rents back to market because these are legacy contracts. So, you know, rents fall behind what the market growth is. And hence, we have the opportunity to push it up. So if today, if I were to renew all the leases in the company, my revenue would just increase 20%. So obviously, those that will happen over a period of time. And then 87% occupancy, has stabilized occupancy has been historically around 94-95%. So as you continue to increase the occupancy by leasing out spaces post the pandemic, you'll continue to see a rental increase. So all of that, as you rightly said, will go to enhance the capital value. And we really think that SEBI has done a fantastic, the market regulator has done a fantastic job on the way they have set up the REIT regulations. You mentioned about the risk reward. So let me kind of just two or three points I want to mention why every individual should seriously consider REITs as a part of their portfolio. Right? Obviously, the risk appetite and considerations would be different for each investor.
If I can just slip in one question, which I was about to ask you. When you talk about this, also talk about where you think it fits into the asset allocation. Where does REIT fit in?
Sure. So a lot of people ask us, is it debt? Is it equity? Is it hybrid? And, you know, we think that real estate by itself and REIT is just a way to participate or play the real estate story. We think real estate itself deserves a separate allocation in investors' portfolio. Of course, it varies from 5% to 50%, depending upon the appetite. So that I think every individual investor needs to take a call on. But basically, real estate has very different characteristics and risk reward compared to what you would do in equity and debt. And that's why we think it's an essential component of every individual's investment portfolio. And within real estate, commercial office, as I mentioned, given the fact that India has a dual structural advantage of both talent and low cost on talent and also on rents, we believe that we'll continue to see large companies come to India and keep expanding, which means the rents will grow up and there'll be more and more demand. There's no other reason that these companies, even though they were not using the office premises or they were restricted from doing so because of the pandemic, they continue to pay 100% of the rents. In fact, Rahul, last two quarters, we've had record leasing in our company, highest since the last 7 years. So while there are a lot of concerns, some on commercial real estate, are people back to work? But what we're seeing is on the contrary, that we're seeing a lot of demand from these global captives, as we call it, global captive companies who are setting up their premises. So I think it's an essential component. Commercial real estate is a long-term growth story. And hence, we believe that every individual investor should participate in this growth story. And then within that, REITs help an individual investor to play the asset class and to participate in the growth story in a risk-adjusted manner, which what I mean by that
is less stressful manner.
In a less stressful manner. You leave it to people who do it for a living. Managing a 4,000 square feet commercial office space where you have a single tenant versus, let's say, Embassy REIT has 34 million square feet. We have about 77 office buildings across the country, and we have about 230, 240 occupiers. So even if five of them go, it doesn't mean the income stops. And then, of course, SEBI has put in a lot of provisions which helps protect individual investors, whether it is how much is the maximum debt that you can take. So we are prohibited by law to take more than 49% of our gross asset value as debt. So, and our balance sheet is AAA rated. The debt that we are able to attract, the cost of debt is one of the lowest in the industry, given you have a AAA balance sheet, given that you have so much of liquidity and, they have so many of assets. So I think that's why commercial real estate through a REIT product is a pretty good way to participate. And two other huge advantages. One, you can invest in a single unit. And today our stock price based on where it's trading would be anyway 350, 370 rupees, right? So you can invest and participate in commercial real estate with as little as 370, 360 rupees and in multiples thereof, and there's no maximum limit. So that's one. Two, there are huge tax advantages just in terms of the way the REIT product works. So the dividends, which are one of the large components of total distribution, the dividends are fully tax exempt. So there are tax advantages to investors, apart from just obviously it being a very very well protected investment from a downside risk perspective. And more retail investors, we have now got increased the retail unit holder base to 16 times from IPO. So from 4,000 now 65,000. Yeah, they understand.
Yeah, even 65,000 is tiny, you know.
We think I've studied
REITs personally because I'd put in some money a couple of years ago. And I've studied it so closely and I double checked and I triple checked. I read all the documents. I'm like, the only concern in my head was, why aren't more people investing? What am I missing, right? It was that kind of a situation. Incidentally, I think in one of our podcasts, which I think is yet to air, the guest actually speaks of look at REITs. He said, a lot of people are missing this opportunity. I need to look at it.
It's great.
5,000 is tiny, if you ask me.
Yeah. So, Rahul, what we have been trying to do, and I do agree with you that this is just tip of the iceberg of the potential in India, because Indians love real estate. And this is, you know, one of the safest ways to play it, which is you hand it to professionals, their tax advantages, and it's a large pool. You know, there's a balanced risk and reward. We're trying to engage with retail investors. We're trying to see if the more and more education that we can do, whether through directly or through our partners. I think the story will spread as we see more and more investors see those regular quarterly dividends. It just reiterates the story that this instrument and this product works really well. There's no magic happening. It's simply you're collecting rents and every quarter you're distributing that to investors, and it's pretty tax efficient. So I think I do agree with you that it should be more, simply because REITs own best in class properties, they operate at scale, and most importantly, they are long tenured contracts. It's not at 1, 2, 3 year contract. Our average contract tenure is 7 years. So that really means that from a downside perspective, it's pretty well cushioned for individual investors should another black swan event happen. Plus, it's transparent, it's liquid, you can just sell it tomorrow.
I think one thing that's going to help REITs in India is when the little more specialized REITs come into play. Like, for example, right now, you are one REIT and it has commercial, incrementally hotels and a little bit of all of this. And I think if there's a REIT which is a play on a high growth sector, let's say those data parks or whatever you call them, data centers and all that. And if there's a REIT which specializes on data centers, or if it's a REIT which specializes on hotels, etc., that may sort of pique people's interest who have already taken a sector view and just want to play a sector as against play an asset class. Maybe that'll help, time will tell.
Yeah. You know, Rahul, if I can pitch in there, I completely agree with you. And I think that's how the market will evolve too. And, in the US, you have REITs of all kinds of properties, industrial, commercial, hotel, single family. So at Embassy REIT, we focus on commercial real estate and office properties. And of course, whatever is ancillary to that we have. So we have few hotels, but office is by far the 95% of the value of the companies in office. There are two other office REITs in the country. So just a span of 3 years since we got listed, we have seen two more REITs come in, and total market cap between the three of us is about 70,000-80,000 crores rupees. So, obviously the market has quickly grown, and between the three REITs, we have raised about 20,000 crores of primary capital fundraise. So, investors are, large global institutional investors as well as retail. And we do think that other asset classes REITs will also come in, which makes it pretty interesting for individual investor to kind of then take a call on which theme they really think suits from the investment appetite perspective.
Okay, and I need to run through some questions with you. You've spoken about Chennai, Hyderabad, Pune. Tell us some other cities that you guys may not have a presence in, but which you are starting to see as potential future opportunities when it comes to commercial, or given your background in residential real estate.
So why don't I just lay it out for commercial real estate? So today we are present in Bangalore, which is our dominant market. Over 70% of our portfolio is in Bangalore. We have a large presence in Pune, in Noida as well as in Mumbai. The two cities we are not present, but we like the dynamics quite a lot, is Chennai and Hyderabad. We are looking at an acquisition in Chennai right now, but in general, Chennai also has the same dynamics, which we like a lot. Large global companies coming in, a ready available talent pool. So a lot of large banks have come into Chennai recently. So we think the demand supply dynamics in that city are pretty attractive. Similar is in Hyderabad, although Hyderabad may have a little bit of an oversupply situation, and hence you need to be really careful on which micro market or which locations you kind of owning properties. Apart from these six cities, Rahul, honestly, in India, if you think from an office perspective, I think the other cities lack scale. So they, you know, over the next couple of years, maybe some of them become large. But you know, given the size at which we are, and given the scale that global occupiers are looking to take up space in India, you really need to offer them scale. It's not about a lakh or 2 lakh or 5 lakh square feet building. You need to have a large scale. You need to have talent available, which in India is abundant, but usually talent also tend to migrate to larger cities for better career prospects and growth. And hence, you have a ready available talent in these large cities. So today, we are present in or like the top six cities in India. I think as we move in the next 5-10 years, I'm sure there are a couple of more cities which will show that demand supply profile that we're looking at. So these are the cities we are in right now.
So I think this kind of underscores the point that if you want to play it premium, play it quality.
And you're not looking at a 2 or 3 year horizon. Yeah. You're a long-term asset owner. So you're going to own it for a long time.
Yeah. So you are a big landlord and you're meeting companies all the time from all over the world, right? Now, I don't want to put you on the spot, but how are you seeing this whole China dynamic play out? Are you having conversations where someone's saying, hey, you know, we were in China, we're looking to move to India? Or, hey, we were thinking of going to China and now we're coming to India? Talk to us a little about that, if you can, please.
Sure. And, you know, Rahul, you know, let me put it this way, that while that dynamic and the feedback that we receive is obviously companies are looking to diversify, so to speak, and have more presence in India. But that's playing out more on the manufacturing side. So that will also obviously impact warehousing in a positive way and some of the other sectors. What we're seeing is, in general, you know, not specific to China, we're seeing more and more appetite to offshore work to India. So what used to happen is, if I break that down, earlier companies used to outsource the contracts to India. So give it to a large Indian player, let's say, and you know, define what work needs to be done and the cost and price of it.
So for example, if JP Morgan wanted to build a software for banking, they'll call TCS and say, hey, can you build it for me? So this work would come to TCS, just as an example.
That's right. So it started off as a technology development play in India in the 2010s and 15s. Earlier, obviously, India moved from voice to back-end office processing to tech development. But what we're seeing today over the last couple of years is large occupiers, and you mentioned some names, they are saying, hey, you know what? We have taken a 10, 15, 20-year call on India or even more. And we will continue to grow structurally in this country. And hence, let us have our own centers in India, which is what we call as offshoring, which is different from outsourcing. But offshoring means it's the same, it's the same occupier who is also expanding its premises in India. And what that means is, one, they're long-term committed to the talent who's working on their deliverables are no longer outsourced people. They are on their own, they are on the rolls of the same company. And hence the quality of office premises that such occupiers would demand from us will be really high. So for example, let's take example of Swiss Re. It's an insurance giant. So what the quality of premises that they would have in their home country, Switzerland, and what they would have in Bangalore would be the same, or very, very close to same, right? And that is because they want to ensure that they provide the same environment, people have the same recognition and the same culture, in India, and that also means the demand for higher quality spaces increased quite a lot. So what I'm seeing is a lot of companies are looking to offshore to India, and you know, a lot of names. And you know, you mentioned about the China factor. We think the US recession, or the fears of recession, and also in UK and other parts of the world, will actually help India more. So we say India offers a pretty sweet spot. If the world is spending a lot on digitalization, on it's spending a lot on technology, which is what we saw immediately, post the first COVID, lockdown. You know, everybody was spending a lot of money to kind of upgrade or transform the digital, the digital presence and undertake a huge transformative projects. India was gaining, and hence we were seeing office demand. And when when there's cost optimization efforts that's happening in the home country of the occupiers, you see more demand to India. That is what we're seeing today, simply because India is a low cost destination which can deliver better quality product, better quality work. So we're seeing demand across the spectrum of occupiers from different regions. It's not specific to one country. And I think the fundamentally the offshoring story in India, where there's the large banks which are now supporting not only the bank and front office operations, now they're supporting analytics, tech development. Large healthcare players are now looking to support research development, their testing services. I can give you many examples. E-commerce, now they have from sales to operations, not just technology. A lot of cloud infrastructure and cybersecurity providers. So, you know, across the spectrum of the new age services occupiers, they're looking to set up. Fintech is another big theme. IT services, you already mentioned. American retailers, they are the other guys who kind of now want to enhance the e-commerce platforms. They are shoring up their retail operations, you know, global retail operations. They're managing it from India. So I think India office phenomenally seeing across the spectrum demand simply because of what the talent is available here.
So I may be oversimplifying, at the risk of oversimplification. You have people who outsourced to India prominently because they were getting the same quality job or better job at a lower price. Now they're putting skin in the game and saying, we'll set up our office here, do it for us. I remember in your presentation seeing that whole JP Morgan building. So they tell you, hey, you know, because make us this building, we'll occupy, do this deal with you for 10, 20 years. So they got more skin in the game. The third is when you mention these retailers who are coming in and doing their back office in India, they're already putting more skin in the game. And possibly it's another step closer to setting up India-facing operations in the future, I guess. It's part of a logical procession. And when that happens, then, you know, more opportunities open up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We are seeing the same. I mean, you know, I would say, how are they going up the value chain? So the higher the quality, higher the overall value creation work they're doing in India, the better the propensity to pay both for talent and for real estate.
Yeah, I think with revenue and profits here, they will pay a lot more. You're right.
Absolutely. And I think that is the play at Embassy REIT, that we like to stick to quality. We often call it top of the pyramid. So if you're a landlord of choice, if you're providing quality premises, if you're flexible, you have those relationships, then large occupiers, for their own offshoring growth story, they need to partner with you. So you know, absolutely well put, Rahul. And we are already seeing that happening. So it's not that their offshoring is just started. Offshoring has been happening since 2015-16. We are seeing more and more of it happening now. And the feedback is typically an occupier would come and start with, let's say, 50,000-60,000 square feet, start with 500 employees. And we keep telling them, please factor for your growth. And they're like, no, we think we'll only double in 3 years' time. We have been participated in the growth story of so many of our occupiers. We say, you will outgrow your own projections very soon. And we have occupiers who started with 50,000-60,000 square feet, and within a span of 5 years, they've grown to 10 lakh square feet, which means from 500 employees to 10,000 employees. And, you know, that's the phenomenal advantage of the way the business model works with the office. So if you were to ask me, because what worries you, you mentioned that about, a real risk. The inflation, of course, it's inflation impacts cost of construction, interest rates, higher interest rates obviously impacts our debt cost, but what would worry us the most is if large occupiers come tell us, who are wanting to come to India, tell us, hey, by the way, because you're not able to find talent. That is what would worry us the most. And obviously, India is in a sweet spot with its demographic profile and its huge population and the STEM talent, that in the next couple of, Morgan Stanley's recent report said India's decade. I do believe it's going to be India's decade. And the talent is the one which is...
Morgan Stanley's report. Was Morgan Stanley?
That's right. It was a fantastic report where, they laid it out in three, simple way, that India will be world's factory. India will be the consumer to the world, and India will be the office to the world. And I really like the way, it just simplifies that you're going to be the factory to the world. You're going to, you're going to be the consumer to the world and also office, which means more and more offshoring to happen in India.
So you preempted the question I was going to ask you about what is the risk. And I think the way you've answered is superb. If the talent was to fall short, the whole story kind of crumbles. But I think at least in the visible future, we can see the talent not falling short. Not that I want to end on a sour note, but I want to ask you, how is the traffic in Bangalore now? Has it got better? Has it got worse? Do you have any client actually complaining to you? Do we really need to come to Bangalore? Can we go somewhere else?
Yeah, so I was hoping you'd not ask that question on a lighter note, but let me give you an individual perspective and also the way we look at it from our business. So obviously, what's happened is as cities have grown, the infrastructure, the cities have grown faster, with the private investments and capital and all the large businesses growing here, whether in our case, the global occupiers, in other cases, other industries growing. And infrastructure has, while it has continued to grow, it's not kept pace with the pace of the growth of the city. So all large cities, in India, including Bangalore, we obviously will have those challenges on traffic. You'll have challenges on connectivity and public transportation. And I must appreciate that the government is trying to do a lot. It's just that the pace of growth is quite a lot. So Bangalore has had its challenges. The good thing about Bangalore is, and this is true for all large, global politics cities, is that as a city grows, the city develops into clusters. So basically, it's not that you have one downtown office. You've seen the case even with Mumbai. So Bangalore would have a North Bangalore. It would have an ORR in the South. Somewhere in the south, southeast, 5 p.m., you would have this core CBD in the center of the city. You'll have a white field, you have an electronic city. So what happens is city develops into clusters. And as the office buildings or office stocks forms and people start, and companies start hiring people, the social and infrastructure develops around it, whether it's residential, whether it's hospitals, whether it's schools. So the good thing about Bangalore is it's got 4 or 5 defined clusters, large clusters. So usually people would tend to stay close by. And what we as landlords do is we want to ensure how can we differentiate ourselves, given that, there is traffic issues and there are connectivity concerns. And can we stand out in some way which makes us more attractive on a relative basis, given the fact that occupiers still want to be part of Bangalore? Because Bangalore has 1/3 of the talent pool in India in terms of STEM talent. Bangalore has 1/3 of unicorns and the largest office stock. So they've taken a call to be here. Then how can we partner with them to see if we can minimize or make it more easier for the employees to access premises? So what we have done is we have invested in infrastructure, keeping a long view in mind. And given our scale, it affords us to spend those monies in the investment. So for example, Embassy Manyata, which is in North Bangalore, one of our largest properties, in fact, probably the largest office park in the country at 15 million square feet. We have invested in partnership with the government, a public flyover. So you will have a flyover which comes directly into the park. One arm comes into the park. So, that really makes it, cuts the journey by 20-25 minutes for an employee who's accessing the park. Then what you've done is we have ensured that we are closer to the metro or the metro stations, the newly planned metros. It's at the neck of our park. So whether it's Embassy Manyata or Tech Village, we're investing in the metro development, you know, in partnership with the government. And third, what we do is we want to ensure there's so many open spaces in the entire ecosystem within the park, whether it's an amphitheater, whether it's open gym, gymnasium, whether it's sports areas, that often people say that your parks don't look anything like what we're seeing on the outside. And I think that really helps. So it is a challenge, but you know, maybe it's also an opportunity of how you can distinguish yourself compared to what the rest of the market can offer to these global companies.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think a lot is being done, but it's a catch-up game, unfortunately. Yes. You know, these are cities which are developing to meet the need as against being proactively planned to do the stuff. But I'm so glad that you guys are doing all the wonderful work and making life easier for your, you know, partners, tenants, partners, whatever you may call them. But, you know, Vikash has been wonderful. Very, very eye-opening. I loved every bit of what we discussed. I especially loved the fact how you sort of helped us understand the how the foreigners are looking at India. You know, the outsourcing, the offshoring. I think that was a great insight. Because even though our viewers may not be investing in property, commercial, etc., or they could choose to go the REIT way, this gives them an insight into how people are seeing India, and you know, the movement of people into India continues to grow. So with that, Vikash, thank you very much for your time. It's been a wonderful, wonderful conversation, and I wish you all the best.
No, Rahul, thank you very much. In fact, it's an honor. It's been a pleasure to be on the show and have a chat with you, and I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rahul. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to the Investor Hour. I'm very excited to hear what you have to say about this episode or the podcast in general. Be sure to write to me at info@equitymaster.com. That's info@equitymaster.com. Thank you once again and see you at the next edition of the Investor Hour. Thank you for listening to the Investor Hour. I'm very excited to hear what you have to say about this episode or the podcast in general. Be sure to write to me at info@equitymaster.com. That's info@equitymaster.com. Thank you once again and see you at the next edition of the Investor Hour.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.